The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
It is that time of the year. There's only about 3 or 4 weeks remaining. It's also a time that individuals think about gifting. And under current tax laws, individuals can give up to $14,000 a year per person without any tax ramifications. We're going to talk about gifting and other ideas for estate planning. Joining me on the program is Adam Sherry. He's with the law firm Anderson & Yoakum. And what I'd like to do today, Adam, is start out with something that is being used, or it's a popular method when, let's say, grandparents or even parents are trying to fund a trust or build up some assets for kids, but they want to exert some kind of control. In other words, they just don't want the kids to get it outright. And there's something that has come out. Gosh, we used to use these a lot in the 80s. It's called the crummy trust. So number one, explain the crummy trust, how it works, the provisions, and the purpose of a crummy trust when it comes to gifting, let's say, to children or grandchildren.
I'd be happy to do that. There's a provision that you mentioned in the Internal Revenue Code that allows individuals to make a gift each year that is not subject to the gift tax, which is currently, as you mentioned, $14,000. So just to clarify that to a certain degree, that's $14,000 per person making the gift. So for instance, a married couple could actually make a gift of $28,000 to a single person. Now, beyond that, just to further clarify it, they could make another $28,000 gift to a separate person. So let's say, for example, somebody had four children or four grandchildren. They could make, as a couple, a $28,000 gift to each one of the four children or grandchildren. Or if they're not a married couple, then it would be a $14,000 gift to each one of the children or grandchildren. And, you know, as you identified, while some people may be interested in taking advantage of this opportunity on an annual basis, that's something that they could do this year in 2015, and then they can do it again in 2016 and thereafter. The persons who they intend to benefit by this gift are not necessarily always in a position where they're ready to accept $28,000 and use it responsibly. Or maybe sometimes, as you also mentioned, the person making the gift wants to make the transfer now, but doesn't necessarily want them to have access to it for a couple years, or, you know, may want to put a certain number of conditions on it. And so by establishing a trust for the benefit of those persons or persons, they can make the gift to the trust, and the trust will kind of hold it like a pot, and then only make distributions according to the terms that are included in the trust. So when we talk about trust and other legal mechanisms for making gifts, the benefit of being able to make a tax-free gift, sometimes we need to balance that against how much is it going to cost to put something like this into place. And one of the benefits of a crummy trust is that you can establish a single trust for multiple different beneficiaries. So if you have those four children or grandchildren, it may be that you only need to establish one trust to benefit all of those children, and that you can continue to contribute to that over the course of a number of years.
You know, we used to use this extensively in the 80s for college funding. They were used back then. Of course, the laws changed and we have all kinds of things like 529 plans. But we're also seeing this used again, at least in my practice, where, let's say, grandparents, and especially in some of the larger estates that we deal with, where we're going to have an estate tax issue because the estates are over $10.8 million, where the parents are gifting assets each year to keep their estate down. But they also want to be in a situation where they don't want the children to have access to, let's say, a lot of money. I mean, you wouldn't think about it, but let's say a husband and wife give up to $14,000 apiece, so $28,000 per child. You start giving away $28,000 a year every single year. You do that over 10 years. You're talking, Adam, a lot of money. So they're a little bit concerned about let's say, the youthfulness or maybe the immaturity to handle money. So they like to do something where there's a little bit more control. Talk about some of the control issues that the crummy trust provides the donor in the case I just described, where they are concerned about maybe the immaturity or, let's say, the age of their beneficiaries.
One of the benefits of any sort of a trust is that you have the ability to separate the legal ownership and responsibility of the assets from the beneficial ownership of the assets. So the children or grandchildren would be the beneficiaries of the assets in the trust. But when it comes to legal ownership and the ability to make decisions, well, that's something that you can put in the lap of a trustee who could be an individual, that's a family friend, or it could be a private professional fiduciary. And that person has the ability to act as a proxy and to make decisions about when to distribute the money in the trust to the beneficiaries, how much to distribute to the beneficiaries at a given time. And one of the really neat things about that is that while there's certain restrictions that need to be observed in all crummy trusts, when it comes to the distribution provisions, you know, so how the money actually gets distributed to the children or grandchildren that they intend to benefit by making the gift, trusts allow for a large amount of flexibility. So the person who's making the gift to the crummy trust has an opportunity to sit down with the attorney who'd be drafting it and really talk through the character of their children or grandchildren, some of the concerns that they might have, and also, you know, on the more positive end, some of the uses that they want the money put towards. And then the distribution provisions of a particular trust are drafted to match those desires or concerns expressed by the person making the gift to the crummy trust. So it's really a great opportunity to both put somebody in charge of watching over the money who you can trust, and then still giving them the sort of leeway and instruction to make distributions of the assets in a manner that you'd like.
Yeah, because let's say the original intentions might be putting money aside for, let's say, a college education. And, you know, depending on market conditions and the length or the amount of gifts made over time, it develops into a substantial amount. What if the child doesn't go to school? Let's say go to college, they go into a trade, or they do something different. They may want to buy a home, so at least the trustee has some of that discretion. How often do you see this? Have you seen this in your practice, Adam? Because one of the things that we have come across, at least in our practice with some of our larger clients where they've made gifts before, let's say a large amount of money given to the children, and you and I can think of one case we worked jointly on, where the money was sort of dissipated. It wasn't spent wisely. And so, you know, a lot of the estate planning has been rethought as a result of that. Do you see crummy trust used in this way?
We see them used for 2 to 3 primary reasons, and they're actually complementary. So oftentimes they're doing it for all 2 to 3 reasons. So one of the big things that we generally advocate is taking advantage of this annual gifting exclusion amount of $14,000 per person per beneficiary. So if somebody is interested in getting assets outside of their estate, so they're not subject to the estate tax on their death, you know, they have this opportunity to make a really significant transfer over a number of years outside of their estate. And, you know, as we identified at the top, the people who they intend to benefit through that annual gift are not necessarily always in that position. So yes, we see a lot of clients who want to take advantage of the annual gift exclusion amount, but the beneficiary isn't necessarily in a position to deal with it. One of the things I want to highlight is that we're talking about something that has a value of $14,000. So that could be any sort of an asset. So oftentimes, clients may have their eye on a particular asset that they anticipate is going to increase in value. And that's something that they may want to get outside of their taxable estate before it experiences that increase so that it could benefit their children or another generation thereafter. And so those are another option where somebody is able to identify this asset, say, you know, I'd like to get this out of my taxable estate before it increases substantially, but I'm not ready to hand it over. And so that is something that we see a lot where somebody has, you know, a specific desire to transfer out of their taxable estate, but is interested in putting some restrictions on how that money is going to be spent. And, you know, if I could just point out one other thing, and your example was great, where let's say somebody ends up going to college on a full ride scholarship or a trade school, or, you know, I mean, the way things work, they could be a computer programmer. It ends up that they don't really have time to go to college because they've come up with a wonderful app or program or something like that. There's restrictions on these 529 accounts and certain other educational accounts that aren't necessarily associated with a crummy trust. So we see it a lot in our practice, and I think it's a really effective tool. So I'm glad that it's something that's available to our clients.
I want to move on to another topic that was basically clarified in 2012 with the Tax Reform Act. Up until that time, you know, in your own industry, it wasn't quite clear what the exemptions were going to be for passing on assets to, let's say, estate tax free to heirs, what the income tax or the estate tax rates were going to be. In 2012, Adam, that got clarified. Currently, the exemption is $5,430,000, I think is the figure. And between an AB trust, you can shelter up to $10.8 million. Prior to that, and for the longest period of time, the exemption was $600,000, then it went to $1 million and gradually rose. A lot of estate planning attorneys, given the exemptions at the time, a lot of people put together trust, what we refer to as an AB trust. Today, with the exemption being so high, for estate tax purposes, that may no longer be necessary. So that's the first point. The second point, you may unwittingly, if you have an AB trust, and I'm just thinking, Adam, of a situation where, let's say a husband and wife have $2 million worth of assets. They have an AB trust. Husband passes away. $1 million goes into the B trust. $1 million goes into the A trust. Eventually, the wife, let's say, lives another 10 years, passes on. Her A trust is now worth $2 million. And let's say the B trust is worth $2 million as well. It grew by $1 million in 10 years. Now, the heirs are facing the possibility of $1 million capital gains tax, which could be 23.8% at the federal level. If you're here in California, it can be as high as 13.3. So you're talking about almost 37% capital gains taxes when, had it just been left in the A trust, all those capital gains would have been forgiven at death. So let's talk about the AB trust and how that may no longer be appropriate and something more suitable to today's environment that offers flexibility, something called a disclaimer trust. Contrast the difference between those two and when an AB may no longer be a valid estate plan for an individual.
Yeah, and I really appreciate the fact that you put it in this historical context, referring to the fact that the exemption amount was as low as $600,000 in recent memory. And since then, we've really gotten some clarity and it's really been increased. So, you know, as you said, they made sense back when the exemption amount was that low, because by establishing the A and the B, you enabled the clients to take full advantage of the estate tax exemption amount for the deceased spouse. And then the surviving spouse was able to use his or her full exemption amount at the point that they passed away. And as you've identified, the increase in the exemption amount has made it so that a lot of people who were in need of an AB trust, given the size of their estate, are no longer in need of that sort of a trust. So I'm really glad you brought this up, because this is one of the first things that we check when we touch base with clients, you know, when we're just checking in with them every couple of years. So we end up looking, you know, do they have an AB trust and what's the current size of their estate? So when they are under the $10.8 million range, rather your example of a $2 million estate made even more sense. The idea that they would have to split it on the first spouse's death, really, first, it's an inconvenience. Just to kind of sketch out what the details of this would look like, they actually do have to establish a separate bank account for the B trust, and they have to keep that account separate. And there's certain restrictions on what they can use that money for and what they can't use that money for. Furthermore, the terms of the B trust really aren't subject to change at that point. So if something were to happen and the provisions of the trust needed to be revised for some reason, that money that's in the B trust is there and it's kind of set in stone. So that's not really able to be changed by the surviving spouse anymore. And then additionally, there's a certain cost of administration that goes along with that when the first spouse passes away. There's more legal work that needs to be done that isn't necessary when you're dealing with something like a disclaimer trust. So to talk about the sort of tax implications of this example that you brought up with the 10-year increase in value, there's no eligibility for a step-up in basis on the second spouse's death for the B trust. So the funds that were transferred into the B trust, while they get to grow tax-free, you know, they're actually growing free of the estate tax, which, as it turns out, isn't relevant in this case, because if that $2 million had been in the A trust along with the survivor, you know, this surviving spouse, he or she is still under the $5.4 million exemption amount. And so they don't necessarily need to have it sheltered in the B trust for estate tax reasons, but they also don't benefit from the step-up in basis that occurs on the surviving spouse's death. So what's the solution? What do we have now that'll work better than an AB trust in this sort of a situation? And it's the disclaimer trust that you referred to. So a disclaimer trust, if no action is taken, there is no B trust that's ever created. It all remains in the surviving spouse's trust, and it's all then eligible for that step-up in basis on the death of the surviving spouse. And so, you know, we then get the benefit of avoiding the increased administration costs of having to separate it out into a separate account, you know, in addition to still being able to benefit from the step-up in basis on the second spouse's death. Now, one of the best things about the disclaimer trust that really makes it such an effective tool is if, for some reason, the B trust was necessary to use the exemption amount of the deceased spouse, you still have the option of creating the B trust. But the positive thing is that you aren't required to create the B trust. So the surviving spouse is able to look at the assets that he or she has. They're able to look at the estate tax exemption amount and determine, you know, by checking in with their financial advisor or their accountant or attorney, and they're able to really stop and think, does this make sense for us, instead of being required to create that B trust. And I really want to highlight the fact that people are required to create that B trust when they have an AB trust. I mean, it's a part of the trust. And so that sort of flexibility that comes along with the disclaimer trust has been a real benefit to a lot of our clients.
Yeah, because people don't realize once it's set in stone like that and it's not modified, even though the laws have changed, it's no longer applicable, but you're still required to do that. So you're going to have two trusts. You could have possible capital gains issues, and you're going to have a little bit more complication because anytime you go from one trust to two trusts, there's all kinds of rules and regulations that come into that. Adam, what would you recommend our listeners do? Because a lot of times, you know, they go and they get an estate plan, they put it in place, and they think, I did that 5-10 years ago. I've got all of that taken care of. I don't need to worry about it. You know, it's just like when it comes to our health, we know that once a year, it's probably a good idea to go in to get an annual physical. I mean, I assume you would recommend this given what happened in 2012 with the clarification on estate tax rates and exemptions, that if you haven't changed your estate plan after 2012, it may behoove you to go get an estate planning checkup. Because I think, Adam, quite honestly, when we point this out, when we're doing, let's say, retirement plans for individuals, when we bring this up, they weren't even aware that this was the issue.
You're absolutely right. And so checking in with your estate planning attorney or, you know, an estate planning attorney, if for some reason your estate planning attorney has retired, just basically checking in with somebody who can take a look at the terms of your trust and really address, is this an AB trust? You know, would you be better served by a disclaimer trust? I would definitely recommend doing that. If you haven't checked in with your estate planning attorney since 2012, now's a great time to do it. And then, you know, using the checkup analogy really makes a lot of sense. And so, you know, we usually recommend that people check in at least every 3 years, and then additionally whenever there's some sort of a major life change. That just gives the client and the attorney the opportunity to take a quick look at the documents and make sure that it still is as good of a fit as possible. And, you know, one thing to highlight is that this is generally a pretty brief meeting with an attorney. I know that as many wonderful attorneys as there are out there, and, you know, I know a lot of really great people, I know that some people are often loath to make an appointment to go meet with their attorney for some reason or another. And I just want to point out that this isn't like embarking on a brand new estate planning process. This is checking in on what's already in place and determining if it still fits. And then you can make a decision, you know, does something need to be changed? But the process of the checkup is, yeah, highly recommended, and it's a pretty painless process.
All right. Given that, I want to move on to something that may make a lot of sense. And we've been in a bull market here for almost 7 years. We know bull markets don't last forever. And there may be those individuals out there that bought Facebook, own Apple or Netflix or Google, whatever the stocks are, where they have substantial gains and they're thinking to themselves, gosh, you know, I have these incredible gains. I know they're not going to last forever because we do have bear markets. But gosh, I don't want to sell them right now because if I do, you know, I'm going to pay, like, for California residents, it could be 13.3% state taxes. You add federal tax, capital gains taxes, which could be 23.8%. Let's talk about a charitable remainder trust, because where you can take a appreciated asset, let's say you own Netflix, Apple, or Facebook, transfer the assets to a trust, avoid the capital gains, but also get a nice tax deduction before the end of the year.
Charitable trusts are kind of like, I think of them as a really positive double whammy when it comes to trust, because you're able to avoid certain amounts of tax on highly appreciated assets or also tax deferred assets without having to give up all benefit to them. So depending on the sort of charitable trust that you may choose or look into, you could receive, you know, an income stream up front. You could set it up so that after you pass away, another person could be receiving an income stream, either for, you know, a fixed term of years or a certain percentage of the assets contributed to the trust. And then at the end of that period, the remainder is distributed to a charity. And so the IRS wants to encourage this sort of charitable giving. And so that's why they allow persons who dedicate a particular amount of the assets that they're transferring to the trust to go to a charity. That's why they allow them to avoid some of the taxes that are associated with either highly appreciated assets or tax-deferred assets. And so it's one of those opportunities where you still get to benefit from the assets that you're transferring in one form or another. You don't have to relinquish control over them. There's certain restrictions within the trust, but you can still oftentimes act as the trustee, and you still can manage those assets after you transfer them into the charitable trust. So if it turns out that it's not a good idea to keep them in their current form, you can sell them, you can turn it into a different type of asset class, and you still experience the tax benefits because you have already transferred them into an irrevocable charitable trust.
So when you do this, there are a lot of considerations that have to go into place. Number one, you are losing some control over it in the sense that, you know, you can't take it back, even though you're going to get the income benefits of it. But also certain kind of assets have certain tax ramifications. For example, the benefit of doing this is if you have assets that have appreciated. In the example that we talked about stocks that have gone up substantially. There are some particular rules when it comes to real estate, especially when there's leverage. I know we don't want to get into this because it gets quite complex. The important point that we want to make is this is if you are considering or if something like this makes sense, this is where you really want to get together with your advisor and let's say your estate planning attorney, because there's all kinds of things that have to be done, the I's dotted, the T's crossed to make this work effectively.
You know, it's going to need to be a team effort. And that team, as you identified, is going to involve the person who wants to create the trust, their financial advisor, an estate planning attorney, And, you know, one of the things that I really can't stress enough how important it is to share all of the information that you have regarding your assets, regarding your goals, you know, with those people on your team, because only when they have a good idea about the other types of assets you have, you know, what your long-term goals are they able to identify the assets that would work best in this sort of a situation, and then also craft the type of trust that would allow you to achieve your goals. So, yeah, it would be impossible for us to engage every possible situation during this sort of a format. But if you're a person who finds this attractive, you do need to kind of consult your team and really make sure that you're sharing as much information as possible so that they can achieve as good of an outcome as possible.
And this is also important in other areas as well, Adam, because one of the areas that we find that we're running into more and more these days, especially over the last decade, is elder abuse. In fact, I'm working on a case today where it was brought to my attention. There's four children, two girls, two boys. One of the sons has been taking money out of the trust as successor trustee, and it just came to our attention as trying to change the beneficiary on over a seven-figure retirement account. And so today we're going to be meeting with the attorney and also with that particular individual, making them aware, is this really their intent to disinherit two of the children for the benefit of, let's say in this case, one particular individual? So when you have a team and people are aware of, you know, one person becomes aware of something, they can alert the other, in this case, the attorney, that, hey, this could be a serious situation. So, you know, it's just like your general physician. You go in, you get a physical, the doctor says, hey, due to a medical condition, I'm going to refer you to a specialist. But it's important for the specialist and the regular doctor to communicate for the best interest of the patient.
I couldn't agree more. And I feel like, you know, this is really private information that we're talking about a lot of the time, but that's exactly why you're entitled to confidentiality when you're talking with these people who are looking after you in a fiduciary capacity. And just to kind of echo the sentiment that you're sharing, and it's so unfortunate that we have so many examples that we could call to mind, but I was working on a case last week, and it wasn't even the person's child who was seeking to take advantage. It was a later in life marriage, and it was a child of one of the spouses who didn't even have the assets, who was attempting to abuse the other spouse. And it was only by keeping everybody informed that we were able to take the same sort of actions to just slow things down, make sure everybody was on the same page. So I really can't emphasize enough how important it is to share that sort of information with the people who are going to be working with you over years or decades.
As we conclude here, Adam, we talked originally, we started out with crummy trust. So for our listeners out there, whether you're a grandparent or parent, you're thinking of making gifts, but you want to maintain some control in terms of how that money's spent or when a child has access to it or for what purposes. A crummy trust is an area that might fit it. And also, if your assets are under $5.4 million, you might want to check up on your trust, especially if it was done before 2012, because 2012 changed so many things. And then, of course, we just talked here about the charitable trust as one way of avoiding substantial capital gains taxes in addition to getting a deduction. Adam, if our listeners would like to find out more about the work that you guys do at Anderson Yoakum, how could they do so?
We have a website at Anderson Yoakum, that's Anderson, YOCUM.com. And our contact information is there, as well as some of the services we offer. So I'd invite them to visit the website.
Adam, well, listen, happy holidays to you, and I hope we'll be talking to you in the new year.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
I have to admit it, Jim, during the entire interview, on every time you talked about a crummy trust, I had to giggle. I thought, if it's a crummy trust, why do you want it, you know?
That was actually named after an individual that took his case to the Supreme Court, and it was named after a court case that was won, and so that's why they call him the crummy. It was named after him.
You know, if we talk about crummy trusts or charitable trusts or disclaimer trusts, we could talk, first of all, about the whole nonsense of having to fight in a country that we're supposed to be free in, and your assets are supposed to be protected against unwarranted seizure, that we have to play all these games to do it. But saying that that is the environment in which we find ourselves, which it is, what you realize now is that the government keeps changing the rules. And so it makes planning very, very difficult. And you always seem to be in this process of jumping through hoops to keep everything stable. It just adds a whole issue of confusion to the mix.
It's a whole process. And you've seen it brought up in the political debates. The tax code has become so complex, John, for this very reason. They're always changing it. Special interest groups get special deductions. Congressmen want to reward those that donate to their campaign. So they're always tinkering with the tax code, and the result is what we're seeing. And so, unfortunately, that's the world we live in. But the important point I'd like to make here as a result of this interview is there were major, major changes impacting a lot of estate plans as a result of the Tax Reform Act of 2012. So if you do have an estate plan that was put into effect, your assets have grown in, let's say, this bull market, either real estate or stocks or a business, it may behoove you to speak with your estate planning attorney and advisor to make sure you unwittingly don't create a tax problem for your heirs and beneficiaries. In the meantime, well, guess what? We've run out of time. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.